In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Many of them were being muscled and strong-armed by the United States so that a majority of these states could not be formed to really call or allow for a meeting of the General Assembly.
If there is an initiative, a movement towards a meeting of the General Assembly which fails as a result of a lack of majority, there is very little that can be done.
Unfortunately, the UN is a helpless, paralyzed body.
I take great pride in my 28 years of service, and George Bush had the arrogance, had the gall to land on a carrier.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, May 2nd, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thousands of war-weary sailors stream down the gangplanks of the USS Abraham Lincoln and into the arms of their families today after nearly 10 months at sea. They were greeted with shrieks of welcome from the parents, wives, husbands, and children they had not seen since they started one of the longest aircraft carrier deployments in recent U.S. military history. Life is about to change, but it is changing in a good way, said Petty Officer Third Class Seth Elrod, 21, of Griffin, Georgia. His four-month-old daughter Grace was born while he was at sea. The sailors were visited yesterday by President Bush, who told them they were homeward bound. Americans following a battle want nothing more than to return home, and that is your direction tonight, the president said, after a dramatic Hollywood-like arrival aboard a S-3B Viking jet. Bush praised the soldiers for their work. He announced an official end to the military phase of the war on Iraq.
In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed. And now our coalition is engaged in securing and reconstructing that country. In this battle, we have fought for the cause of liberty and for the peace of the world. Our nation and our coalition are proud of this accomplishment. Yet it is you, the members of the United States military, who achieved it. Because of you, our nation is more secure. Because of you, the tyrant has fallen. And Iraq is free.
Bush was careful not to declare the war formally over. Doing so would require that all the troops be brought home, and that could hamper the hunt for Saddam Hussein. The U.S. would then, according to international law, be considered an occupying force. During deployment, pilots aboard the carrier flew thousands of bombs dropping sorties from its deck as part of the war in Iraq. Bush praised the troops for conducting what he characterized as a largely humanitarian mission.
When Iraqi civilians looked into the faces of our servicemen and women, they saw strength and kindness and goodwill.
Bush left by aircraft this morning before the vessel docked. Meanwhile, in what is purported to be his last known wartime speech, a video never before televised, Saddam Hussein appears exhausted, at times confused, and seemingly resigned to defeat. But he tells Iraqis that God somehow will help them expel the American-British occupiers. The faithful will be victorious over the sinners, regardless of the duration of the struggle and the forms it might take, Saddam says. With patience, quote, the ordeal can become overcome, he says, and the invaders driven from Iraq. The videotape bearing a presidential stamp was obtained by the Associated Press Television News from a former employee of the Iraqi satellite television channel, which under the regime was responsible for filming and distributing official presidential video. The employee said it was made on April 9th, the day the American troops steamed into central Baghdad and pulled down a towering Saddam Hussein statue. But while the president and other Pentagon officials praise the fall of the Saddam Hussein regime and the arrival of democracy, or so-called democracy, to a nation that's lived under the dictatorship for over three decades, distrust and hatred of America is running high in many parts of Iraq. The London Telegraph reports that on the streets of Fallujah, where Iraqis launched grenades into the U.S. military compound yesterday, wounding seven and damaging vehicles, Iraqis are shaking their fist at foreigners and vowing to take revenge. Outside the mayor's office, which is next to the American compound. They've displayed banners reading, "Man can be destroyed, not defeated," and, quote, "Sooner or later, U.S. killers, we will kick you out," unquote. Peace Watch correspondent Raphael Kraft visited Fallujah today and files this report.
Live chickens, spiced tomato and fruit stands. The market of the city of Fallujah, 40 miles west of Baghdad, is crowded with people doing their shopping before attending the traditional Friday prayer. Along with the fruit and vegetables, there is a lot of activity around the weapons stands where one can buy a Kalashnikov machine gun for some $50. Every caliber is available and people are eager to shoot in the air. Along with running water and electricity, there is a lack of security in Iraq. It is the main worry of most Iraqis as the looting hasn't stopped since the Saddam regime was toppled by the Americans. Mohammed Abdelkarim, a resident of Fallujah, believes social peace depends on the will of the Americans.
I hope American people, they can control their weapons and they can take it from the people. Inshallah, it will be easy when you make something safe for them. Good condition, everything available, they will give you their weapons. We want proof from them what they are doing, what they're going to do in the future. It will be something safe for the Iraqian or kills Iraqian. I don't know, until now we don't know anything, their situations and our futures.
Recent events in Fallujah have severely strained relations here. Monday and Wednesday, a total of 16 Iraqis were killed by American troops as they protested against the American presence in Fallujah. Yesterday, 7 U.S. soldiers were injured in a grenade attack by Iraqi militants. Hatam runs a small convenience store in Fallujah souk.
The American manager, chief here in Fallujah city, he say, I come this city, I take care about the people. He no care about the people. He killed the people. He no care. Just say the people here, down USA, he opened the fire. For what? For nothing.
Fallujah is also called the city of the mosques in Iraq, and since law enforcement is absent, social peace strongly depends on Muslim clerics. Sheikh Shakar, imam of the Al-Kabir Mosque, says those who died at the beginning of the week are martyrs, and American troops should leave not only the town, but the entire country. But in his sermon, Sheikh Shakar insists Fallujah's inhabitants should be reasonable and avoid approaching and provoking American troops. He also told his followers that America has committed crimes against humanity in Iraq, especially in Fallujah. Conscious that the political future of Sunni clerics in a Shiite-dominated country will strongly depend on the U.S. administration, imams in Fallujah have to use a double language to satisfy both their followers and the American soldiers. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Raphael Kraft in Fallujah, Iraq.
In his 20-minute speech last night aboard the USS Abraham Lincoln, whose planes dropped nearly one-third of the bombs that rained down on Iraq, President-elect Bush said the Iraq invasion was merely one small part of a broader fight that he pledges the U.S. will continue to pursue against al-Qaeda and other terrorists around the world.
The Battle of Iraq is one victory in a war on terror that began on September the 11th and still goes on. By seeking to turn our cities into killing fields, terrorists and their allies believed they could destroy this nation's resolve and force our retreat from the world. They have failed. We have not forgotten the victims of September the 11th. With those attacks, the terrorists and their supporters declared war on the United States. And war is what they got.
But despite all the bellicose rhetoric coming from the commander-in-chief, his praise of American servicemen and women, and his dramatic aerial arrival yesterday aboard the Navy S-3B Viking jet, some critics have been quick to remind us that the military record of Bush himself is a bit lacking. According to military records from the Vietnam War, Bush served in the Army National Guard, but from the period of May 1972 through October 1973, he failed to report for weekend duty. For clarification of Bush's background, Peace Watch gave a call today to retired Lieutenant Colonel Bill Burkett, who served in the military for 28 years, including as war plans officer during Operation Desert Storm. From 1995 until his retirement in 1998, he also served as state plans officer for the Texas Army National Guard under then-Governor George W. Bush. Burkett alleges there was a widespread practice of delaying filing forms to remove names of soldiers no longer in service, thus continuing to receive federal funding for personnel that no longer existed. Burkett asserts when we went public with this information, he was refused medical treatment for a near-fatal illness he developed while on a tour of duty in Panama. We started our discussion with Burkett describing how he knew Bush's potentially embarrassing and controversial past was hidden from the public during his campaign to become Texas governor.
In 1996, it was common knowledge. I was assigned and I was on full-time duty working for the Adjutant General of the state of Texas. My duty assignment title was State Plans Officer for the Texas National Guard, but I reported on day-to-day and minute-to-minute operations to the Adjutant General, General James. Within that, I was, in essence, a consultant, if you would, had somewhat of a consulting relationship to the Adjutant General. I was daily meeting with General James once, twice a day. I was in his office, and he got a call from the governor's office. Joe Albaugh, Dan Bartlett were on the phone. Joe Albaugh is currently the FEMA director. Dan Bartlett is currently director of White House Communications. And within that conversation, I almost always stepped outside into the waiting room, an outer office where General James's secretary, Henrietta Balderas, was. I stepped there. Henrietta was not there at the moment. I simply stood, and I overheard a phone call. The phone call statement was given to General James to that Karen Hughes was going to take a look at the military records of General James, that she needed to do some background because she was writing an autobiography in preparation for Bush to run for re-election and potentially for the presidency, and that he needed to get those files accumulated and make sure that Karen Hughes could access that information. I then was in the coffee area. General James came out, and in the presence of General Wayne Marty, he directed a state services officer. I believe really he directed General Marty, and General Marty then referred to the state services officer to get those files accumulated out of retained records and make sure there wasn't anything in there that would embarrass the governor. Mm.
So how did you become involved in this whole scenario, other than the fact that you overheard this conversation?
At the time, we were working other issues. I was the one that reported that the Texas National Guard had developed a scheme, and I reported this to General James first and later to Dan Bartlett of the governor's office, a scheme in which we kept people on the payroll long after they left service. We kept them on the books, which was falsifying personnel reports and readiness reports in order to continue to receive massive federal dollars. All of these things were occurring simultaneously and in parallel. I did mention immediately, and I have given this information to USA Today's investigative reporters, and they spent several months verifying it and, in fact, spent 5 days on site in Austin, Texas, and corroborated the information. But I was told that the story was killed by their editors.
And so tell us exactly what this scheme involved with the ghost soldiers.
Okay, the ghost soldiers, basically what was going on is, if you'll fast forward that from 1968 through 73 to a time period in 1995 to 1998, what the Texas National Guard was doing when an individual would either, for whatever reason, transfer out of a unit or would retire, They would stall that paperwork for a series of months and even in some cases years in order to continue to receive federal assistance and to receive readiness status on units at an exaggerated high level.
And so you decided at some point to blow the whistle?
I blew the whistle on the readiness reports, and as a parallel issue, this other issue came out. The issue of Bush's records came out.
Mm-hmm.
George Bush did not meet his contract. George Bush did not provide full service in that 17-month period. He gave 4 good years, or what are called good years of service, on a six-year contract, and there were other situations in which he was ordered to duty and he did not appear and did not, in fact, respond. That occurred in the Vietnam era.
Do you have any documentation to prove that the conversation that you alluded to, where there was a directive given to make sure that George Bush's records were cleaned up so that nothing embarrassing would come out. Do you have any documentation to prove that that did happen? How do we know that, you know, you're not just, you said you don't have a political axe to grind or a vendetta, but are there any witnesses? Is there anything on tape or anything in writing?
Well, it's a very valid question, and I respect you for asking it, just like I respected the people at USA Today, Dave Moniz and his team. As a consultant, I took on the practice of doing daily reports and what we call closeouts, and things, events that were triggered throughout the day that either struck me as positives or negatives or whatever, I noted those. I did note on that day, within my daily diary, if you want to call it that, which is more anything a management report, I did note the occurrences that occurred there. I also spoke on that very day with CW3 George O. Kahn, who he and I worked together at the Texas National Guard, and with CW4 Harvey Goff. I mentioned it to both of them on that very day, and it troubled me. It troubled me that significantly. The USA Today folks have since corroborated my story with Mr. Kahn and with Mr. Goff. And by the way, both of them were kicked out of the Texas National Guard after they provided that documentation within my court case.
How would you characterize the damage that would have been done to President George Bush's career had this information been widely disseminated?
Well, I was asked that question as recently as late last night. If we will, and here's the way I choose to look at this. The political lines are clearly drawn between the Democrats and the Republicans, and people always want to go back and say, well, this is a purely political or hate issue. It's not that to me. I am a professional. I take great pride in my 28 years of service, and my service I consider to have been highly moral and highly ethical. If we do a direct comparison, what brought this up last night was George Bush had the arrogance, had the gall to land on a carrier, trying to again build this image about being a great fighter pilot, and all of this image, which in his autobiography, Karen Hughes later absolutely was totally contrary to his service records. There was a direct inconsistency all the way through. If that image were true, I would still question his moral leadership and his ethical judgment. Even his father, who was considered by some to be a military hero, and that has been brought into some question at some point, but even his father, Bush 41, would have never pulled a stunt like was done yesterday, which simply rubs the people's face in trying to build an image for re-election, and an image being a fighter pilot or of a war hero, which is a crock. It's literally a crock. I had men who worked for me and who served under my command, and it brings tears to my eyes to think about these guys that went to Vietnam and went to service because they did volunteer. George Bush claimed to have volunteered, but there's no record of that. They went to Vietnam, and two of those guys died. Now, it brings tears to my eyes, and it hurts me as a commander, and it hurts me deeply as a man of great, or at least what I think is ethical and moral strength, to look back and see that they would have never stepped forward and made all of these brash claims of service that they didn't perform. they performed, and they performed quietly and with great dignity. And that here is an individual who just steps up and with arrogance creates an image that he cannot support. He can't even compare to his own Bush 41 family. If you go back to James Earl Carter, President of the United States, who was on active duty longer than any president other than General Dwight Eisenhower in America's history, Carter never pulled this, not once. Dwight Eisenhower, five-star general, he would never have pulled this. Why do we have this brashness, this youth, this arrogance, and this overstatement when this is the very man who constantly made a political theme of trying to attack the credibility of the person that was on the other side of the debate, Al Gore, about embellishing? If this isn't an embellishment, I don't know what is.
So you were offended by this whole staged event last night where the president flew in on the aircraft carrier.
As a veteran, as a man that served and saluted George W. Bush as governor, as a man of uniform for 28 years and a man that raised his right hand and took an oath to provide service and defense of the Constitution and of the people of this country, I was absolutely, morally, ethically offended beyond your belief.
Lieutenant Colonel Bill Burkett served as state plans officer for the Texas Army National Guard from 1995 to 1998 under then-Governor George W. Bush. Burkett collapsed at the airport when returning from Panama in 1998. The military refused to authorize treatment for him for more than 154 days. He sued in lower courts and lost an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which has refused to hear his case. Today, Burkett has lost the use of 60% of the right side of his body and suffers from acute seizures. He was diagnosed with meningoencephalitis.
They call me W, that's W, but my real name is Fugia. And I don't care who's on my side, you protesters can't nick my hide. I'm plunging deep into this bride, a stubborn dude who's stiff with pride. And I will not be swayed. Make no mistake, I'll be obeyed. My orders come not from above. With glee, my hawk will kill your dove. No, I will not be swayed. I'm a spoiled boy who never learned to speak. See the silver spoon stuck between my teeth. I may not know much of this world. My ignorance has been unfurled. Still, right now, I got plenty power. I made this Congress bow and cower. It's 9/11 that made me strong, and terrorism is my song. Watch me levitate on fear. Invest your bucks in duct tape here.
The W Banjo Rap by Fran Carbonaro. While American and British soldiers return home from the Persian Gulf, famed Egyptian feminist and novelist Nawa el-Saadawi and a handful of Arab scholars and activists met earlier this week with Daniel Turk, who's United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan's spokesperson and representative on political affairs. The purpose of their meeting was to convey their concerns about the future of Iraq and the humanitarian catastrophe caused by the U.S.-led invasion. Peace Watch correspondent Barbara Nimri Aziz sat in on the meeting as Turk responded to criticism of the Secretary General's failure to speak out more forcefully in the lead-up to the U.S.-led war on Iraq.
It's not that the Secretary General was silent. I mean, his views were sometimes opposed, but he expressed his view. Now, his view, of course, is strengthened if there are followers. But I can tell you, among the membership, the divisions were very strongly pronounced, and the General Assembly immobilized as a result. So that's reality.
But there is a Security Council, and
yes,
then there is a General Assembly.
Yes.
Now, the Security Council has met many times over this issue,
yes,
but the General Assembly has not.
Yes.
And this would be, if there was ever a crisis in the United Nations, this definitely constitutes a crisis. And this would definitely be a moment to bring, in any community, when you have a crisis, the time is to bring everybody together to discuss it.
This is a problem for the UN, absolutely. I mean, there were discussions among delegations because, you see, to convene a session of the General Assembly, you need a majority, and that majority did not emerge. As you know, the non-aligned movement, which met in Kuala Lumpur in early March, has initiated that. But of course, and they are numerically the majority in the United Nations, but the action that followed did not yield a majority. So there is another problem there. I mean, if there is an initiative, a movement towards a meeting of the General Assembly which fails as a result of lack of majority, there is very little that can be done.
A debriefing was held following the meeting with Daniel Turk. Many of the delegates were unable to attend the appointment with Turk because of a last-minute scheduling change by the UN, so this was their first opportunity to hear how that dialogue transpired. Peace Watch correspondent Karen DeAndre was there and files this report.
Fawzi Afzal Khan, professor from Montclair State University, began by explaining a rather surprising answer from Turk regarding why the UN had not called a General Assembly prior to the war.
He said something very interesting. He said there were a lot of closed-door negotiations going on, a lot of pressure being put personally by Mr. Annan himself on these, the governments and representatives of these different governments around the world. And many of them came, were being muscled and strong-armed by the United States, not so that a majority of these states could not be formed to really call or allow for a meeting of the General Assembly.
Khan reported that when asked flatly about Kofi Annan's resignation by Dr. Sadawi, Turk said that he didn't think that would be useful or helpful.
Nawal raised the question of whether it would be a useful and an important gesture for Mr. Annan to tender his resignation if, in the face of the fact that the UN has in fact been totally humiliated by the United States and him not being able to really fulfill his obligations, whether that would be a good gesture, an important symbolic gesture, to which, of course, the expected reply was no. It would not be a good gesture because it would accomplish nothing, and in fact, it would be a one-time gesture, and it would further nullify the power, if any, or prestige of the United Nations, and he didn't think that that was the way to go. But in any case, we as the delegates made it clear that, we feel that in his position, that is something that would have, would have some meaning. It would send some sort of resonating image across the world that here is the leader of this body that has been systematically sidelined and, completely ignored. And so as a symbolic gesture, it would be a good thing to do.
As part of furthering the message, the delegation is also planning a trip to Baghdad, Damascus, and Cairo to take a similar letter to the Secretary General of the Arab League and stand in solidarity with the Iraqi people. Turk thought it might be unsafe for them to travel into the country. To ease the delegates' concerns, he added that there will be some humanitarian aid from Amman beginning next week, but it will only come overland and only to southern regions.
One of the points that Mr. Turk made was that there is really no basic UN presence other than Iraqi local UN employees presently in Iraq. And when I think Sokar asked and a couple of other people asked about how the UN sees its presence in Iraq now, the word he used was the coalition has said that the conditions there are not permissive. So basically what we're looking at as a group of people who want to go to Iraq at all is who's in charge of saying when anyone can go. And at this point, the coalition is determining whether or not the UN can come in under the conditions that they call permissive.
That was Lorraine Carroll from the University of Southern Maine. She also said that the coalition would determine if or when the UN might be allowed back in, and that the little humanitarian aid that would come in the south would not reach Baghdad. There was general consensus among the delegates that the meeting was successful in getting their message to Kofi Annan, and that the 45-minute dialogue with Turk was a positive sign. They raised some serious questions with Turk regarding the ability of the UN to fulfill its mission of protecting sovereign states from aggression by more powerful nations, but still found some hope.
Here is a body that was created to try to protect sovereign states from aggressive and completely lawless actions of larger nations that demonstrate aggression against them. And it hasn't been able to do that. I mean, you know, we are obviously seeing a world in which unilateralism holds sway, and the United States has become so powerful militarily and economically, it can do just what it pleases and in complete contravention of international law, of the Geneva Conventions and so on. So what can be done? I mean, why the UN is in fact become a totally powerless body. And so he did say that what he felt, and I actually encouraged by his response, I understood that what he was saying is, people in the UN and obviously other people in powers of position around the world have taken note of this tremendous, you know, outpouring across the world of citizens of different states coming out into the streets and saying no to the policies of their governments. And while we may not have seen the results of that at this particular moment, it is something that, you know, we should not let up in our efforts. He said the only way for the UN to develop and get back some of its power, become truly powerful, perhaps that's the proper, you know, or have some input into the international scene, the only way for that to happen is if the representatives to the UN from all the individual states around the world feel that they've got to stand up and take a stand. And they will only do that if they feel pressured by their citizens in their home countries. So I think we as a group particularly should think of, I mean, we are a representative body of, in fact, international citizens. To me, that is a wonderful sign.
For the full detail of the letter and the demands, you can go to www.nawalsadawi.net. That's www.nawalsadawi.net. This is Karen DeAndre for Pacifica Peace Watch.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.